From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Lush Life, we discuss the life and work of composer Billy Strayhorn with his biographer David Haydu. Strayhorn was Duke Ellington's closest collaborator. As a gay man, Strayhorn found security in the Ellington organization, but musically, he remained in Ellington's shadow. Also, we hear a concert and interview with one of our favorite singers, Susanna McCorkle, recorded at the 1996 Public Radio Conference. McCorkle has a new CD of Cole Porter tunes. And book critic Maureen Corrigan has some more suggestions for summer reading. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Aides to Russian President Boris Yeltsin are concerned that the low turnout in today's runoff election could hurt his chances of defeating communist Gennady Zyuganov. Turnout so far is lower than in the first round of voting. But exit polling done by CNN in the far eastern area of the country, where the polls are now closed, shows Yeltsin with a lead. NPR's Ann Garrels reports Yeltsin voted today in a village outside Moscow, and he offered an explanation for his absence from public appearances during the last week.
President Yeltsin explained his sudden change of plans by saying he had exceeded his planned targets for talking to journalists by 120% this year. Subsequent Kremlin footage of the frail 65-year-old president voting in the countryside showed that, though stiff, he can walk and talk, and he seemed slightly improved from a taped appearance on Monday. Many Russians remain unaware the president's been sick, and those who support him seem unfazed, saying, "He's got a good team. What's the difference?" Despite a vigorous get-out-the-vote campaign, turnout overall is down 5% from what it was in the first round. For the Yeltsin team, this is key. Analysts say there are limited but devoted communist supporters. While support for Yeltsin may be greater, it's soft, and many, like young people, do not vote with the same dedication as elderly communists. I'm Ann Garrels in Moscow.
Electrical engineers are trying to figure out what caused yesterday's massive blackout across much of the western U.S. The outage affected parts of at least seven states and two Canadian provinces, shutting down subway cars in the San Francisco Bay Area and casinos in Las Vegas. Hospitals and air traffic control systems were forced to use emergency generators. The one-and-a-half-hour blackout occurred at a time of peak electrical usage and record-breaking heat. The U.S. is reportedly making some progress in the search for those behind last week's deadly truck bombing in Saudi Arabia. The blast killed 19 Americans. Dave Mattingly reports.
Today's Washington Post reports U.S. officials have identified individuals who cased several American military housing sites in Saudi Arabia before the bombing in Dahran. The report says U.S. intelligence officials believe those individuals passed through Syria and perhaps other countries in the Middle East before the blast, and that they were aided by other nations. The newspaper quotes a senior Air Force official in Dahran as saying about 6 weeks before the bombing, a police officer using binoculars spotted someone apparently casing the military housing complex in Dahran, but they fled after realizing they were being watched. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
The Federal Reserve is expected to announce in a couple of hours whether it will hold the line on interest rates or increase them to prevent a resurgence of inflation. Most private economists have predicted the central bank's policymakers will decide to hold rates steady for now. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 25 points at 5,695 in active trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is down 7.5 points. This is NPR News. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is pledging continued U.S. aid to Poland. Speaking in Warsaw today, Mrs. Clinton said the U.S. will provide grants to help non-governmental organizations promote civic involvement in the country's economic and political reforms. Mrs. Clinton is on a goodwill tour of Eastern Europe. Israel's foreign minister is threatening to quit if Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't find a cabinet job for retired general and political veteran Ariel Sharon by next week. David Levy said the new government is not complete without Sharon. Toronto, Ontario has passed the most sweeping anti-smoking ban in North America. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
As of the 1st of January, 1997, you won't be able to light up in any restaurant, bar, or entertainment center in the city of Toronto. In a decisive vote, Toronto City Council adopted what's thought to be the most exclusive ban in all the U.S. and Canada. One council member highlighted her speech in favor of the ban by displaying a tray she said was full of the medication a smoker friend of hers has to use. Others testified that secondhand smoke cost the province of Ontario $3.7 billion a year in treatment of related illnesses. There are 50 municipalities in the U.S. that ban smoking in restaurants, including New York and Aspen, and California and Vermont also ban restaurant smoking. But Toronto wants to make all public places in the city smoke-free by the year 2000. I'm Jackie Lydon in Toronto.
President Clinton is expected to announce $10 million in federal grants for programs to combat truancy and to keep drugs and guns out of public school buildings. In a speech this afternoon to the nation's largest teachers union, Mr. Clinton will unveil his anti-truancy program. The administration is also releasing a truancy handbook for schools and parents. The manual suggests that school districts adopt a zero-tolerance policy for students who skip class. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's take the A-Train. Since it was the longtime theme of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, you might have assumed Ellington wrote it. He didn't. It was written by his longtime associate, Billy Strayhorn. Strayhorn composed and arranged for the Ellington Orchestra from 1939 to his death in 1967 at the age of 51. Strayhorn wrote many beautiful melodies. His best-known song was the ballad Lush Life. He co-wrote Satin Doll and was the sole composer of many compositions in the Ellington Band's repertoire. Strayhorn's life has been the subject of much speculation. A new biography attempts to separate the myths from the facts. My guest is the author David Haidu, who is also an editor at Entertainment Weekly. Haidu has compiled a companion CD called Lush Life, the Billy Strayhorn Songbook, featuring music from the Verve archives. From it, this is Strayhorn's 3 and 6, featuring Strayhorn at the piano, Johnny Hodges on alto saxophone, recorded in 1958. David Haidu says Ellington took credit for some of Strayhorn's compositions, such as Overture to a Jam Session, and took co-composer credit for the Strayhorn songs Daydream and Something to Live For. Haidu says Strayhorn traded off recognition for the security of working with Ellington.
It's important to remember that they entered into this relationship with utter complicity, and they both had their reasons, and it was advantageous to both of them for a long time. It's essential to factor in to your understanding of this that Strayhorn was not only gifted and could perhaps have gone on to great things by himself, but was African-American like Ellington, but also homosexual at a time when it was very difficult for a public figure to be homosexual and to be open about it, to be public about it. And Strayhorn made himself a triple minority by making a decision very early on to not hide his homosexuality, to be forthright and extremely open by the standards of the 1940s about being gay. He brought his companions and friends to recording sessions. He was traveled with them. He was utterly comfortable with being gay, and knew that, as his friends described to me, knew that he couldn't. That would have to sacrifice. Were he to be a public figure. So he made a decision, well, what could I be? Can't be open, honest, forthright about my sexual orientation and be a famous band leader, particularly in jazz. So he sacrificed fame and fortune to be true to himself.
Let's listen to one of Billy Strayhorn's most famous and loved songs, and this is the song Lush Life. You have actually brought with you a recording of Billy Strayhorn singing the song and accompanying himself at the piano. What is this recording from?
The recording goes back to 1960. It was done in the apartment of Aaron Bridgers, a wonderful pianist and a dear man who was Strayhorn's roommate for 10 years in the 1940s. Aaron moved to Paris in the late 1940s and has been there ever since. He's still a performing pianist in Paris. I spent a lot of time with Aaron in Paris, and he went through their family albums with me and their picture albums and pulled out pictures for me of Strayhorn and Aaron with Billie Holiday in clubs and Strayhorn with Lena Horne. And they remained friends even after Aaron relocated to Paris. And Strayhorn was a Francophile. He loved Paris. He went at every opportunity, and he returned in 1960 to work on a film, Paris Blues, that Aaron appears in, by the way. And in his apartment, he recorded this version of Lush Life.
Well, let's hear it. This is Billy Strayhorn.
Life is lonely again. And only last year, everything seemed so sure. Now life is awful again. A trawful of hearts could only be a bore. A week in Paris will ease the bite of it. All I care is to smile in spite of it. I'll forget you, I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive. And there I'll be while I rot with the rest of those whose lives are lonely too.
That's Billy Strayhorn, and my guest David Haydew is the author of a new biography of Strayhorn called Lush Life. You know, it's interesting to me listening to that recording of Strayhorn singing Lush Life. His music and this song has such a sensual melody line. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't have a beautiful voice. You know, he has a very serviceable, mm-hmm. at best, kind of voice. Mm-hmm. I was surprised
hearing
his voice. I was surprised hearing his voice. It's not what I expected.
No, it doesn't have, say, the elegance or the smoothness that you'd expect from him. But it's not surprising in that it's honest and it's true. Mm-hmm. And if there's one thing that you find that all of his music has in common, it's veracity. It's an honesty. That's why some of it's a little difficult to hear. There's a lot of pain in some of Strayhorn's music. There's a lot of yearning and there's anguish. And some of his music just cries and moans. There are pieces like Passion Flower and Something to Live For. Chelsea Bridge, A Flower is a Lovesome Thing, and they're aching songs. They're very emotionally rich and emotionally honest.
Lush Life is a song about a lost love, and Strayhorn was very young when he wrote this. He really hadn't experienced what he was writing about at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, the song can't be taken literally. When he was asked about the song, he said that he answered very cryptically about it. It's a song written by a young boy who had virtually never left Pittsburgh, who lived in a house without electricity and no paintings on the wall, not even any paint on the wall, about living an exotic, continental, cosmopolitan life. The song is a prayer. The song is a dream image of sophistication. If taken too literally, the song loses everything. It's a dream. It's a wish.
When Strayhorn started working for Ellington, they had really a very unconventional financial relationship. What relationship did they have?
Well, they had no financial relationship. That's what was unconventional about it. They had no deal. They had no contract. They hooked up. They started working together. They started writing music. It went well. And Ellington started paying his bills, and that never stopped. And it continued right until the end of his life.
Now, so you mean instead of giving him a salary, he would just pay his expenses?
Right. Now, he did get some royalties for his compositions. He did get some stock in Ellington's publishing company, Tempo Music. But for the most part, most everything was just taken care of. If Strayhorn needed to travel or wanted to travel or wanted to rack up a hotel bill or a clothing bill, the Ellington Organization paid for it. If he needed medical attention, the Ellington Organization paid for it. For the most part, it was something like being kept. Now, that sounds really peachy. It sounds wonderful. But it was daunting. It had to have been daunting for Strayhorn to face the proposition of that ending someday. What if he wanted to leave? How do you do that? How all of a sudden, one day, how do you figure out what it takes to live and what your budget is and what your budget should be? And how do you do life insurance?
Do you know if Strayhorn was comfortable with the financial relationship that he had with Ellington?
Yes, strictly speaking, strictly in terms of finances, he was comfortable. The finances were never the problem in his life. It was never really the issue. He could always do pretty much anything he wanted. I've seen what he paid for clothing, and I've seen some of his restaurant tabs that were, you know, among his private papers that I studied for writing my book. And he lived a nice life. He never had much in the bank, but he lived well. Money was never the problem. The problem with Strayhorn was his independence. He could never break out if he wanted to, for a variety of reasons. So he stayed with Ellington, and it wasn't always as rewarding emotionally and artistically as it could have been. And he ended up drinking himself to death and died much too early, and at the age of 51 in 1967.
Well, he had cancer of the esophagus?
He had cancer of the esophagus, which could have been brought on by, he also smoked like crazy, like a chimney, could have been brought on by smoke, alcohol, combination of the two. But he went through a degeneration over the last decade brought on by alcohol abuse that was quite harrowing. It was quite debilitating in his last several years.
What impact did it have on Duke Ellington when Strayhorn died?
Well, personally, he was devastated. He describes in his own memoirs just, you know, weeping and weeping and literally banging his head against the wall. He spoke at Strayhorn's funeral, and I've seen a film of it. It was just a ghost of himself. He was extremely distressed for some time. But then what he did is he buried himself in his work and ironically became more productive than he had ever been before, more prolific than ever. He wrote more music from 1967 to his death in 1974 than he did at any other time. He just buried himself in his work. He focused a lot of that work on sacred music, too. I think that there's no question, and Mercer Ellington and others have told me this from their firsthand experience, that Strayhorn's death reminded Ellington of his own mortality, which was a fearsome prospect, to say the least. And faced with the reality of death, he turned to sacred music, although he had always been somewhat religious. He had been quite religious, actually. But he dedicated himself largely to music invoking God and spirituality for his last several years.
I just want to clarify, when you say that Strayhorn drank himself to death, you're not implying that he was, like, just so miserable with the relationship he had with the Ellington Orchestra that caused him to drink himself.
Oh, God, oh, gosh almighty, no. He drank from the get-go to celebrate life. There's much more complicated than that. He was a bon vivant, and he loved to toast. He drank out of joy. He also drank out of despondency. He just drank and smoked. The combination was his undoing. Even though the death certificate, it was cancer of the esophagus, and in the end the degeneration that he suffered over the last several years of his life was clearly a result of abuse of both alcohol and tobacco.
After Billy Strayhorn died, Duke Ellington took his orchestra into the studio to record a whole album of compositions by Strayhorn. The album's called And His Mother Called Him Bill. Why don't we hear Lotus Blossom from that album? Do you want to say anything about this before we hear it?
Oh, it's one of my favorite performances, and it's Duke's performance of one of his favorite Billy Strayhorn songs. I heard many, many times that Ellington used to like to sit alone at the piano after a performance, after a concert, and he would play Lotus Blossom over and over. Some people speculated he was trying to figure it out, trying to understand how Strayhorn could compose something with so much beauty and so much music theory at the same time. Whatever the reasons, it's a very powerful and emotional song. When the recording sessions were done for And His Mother Called Him Bill, the sessions are finished, the record's wrapped up, people are packing up their equipment and leaving the studio, Duke sat down at the piano again and played Lotus Blossom for himself. And it was a personal performance. It was him remembering Billy. He stopped. He made a few mistakes. The session was imperfect. The recording is imperfect because you could hear people packing up in the background and talking to each other. But the producers found it so powerful, and you'll hear yourself, that it was included on the record. So that's all I wanted to say.
David Haydu, thank you very much for talking with us about Billy Strayhorn.
Oh, I had a wonderful time.
David Haydu's biography of Billy Strayhorn is called Lush Life. Coming up, some good books for the holiday weekend. This is Fresh Air. If this 4th of July weekend finds you loaded down with hot dogs and hamburgers, but light on literature, book critic Maureen Carrigan has some suggestions for diverting vacation reading.
Walter Mosley's Easy Rollins series is slowly slouching its way into a historical period more of its readers can remember. The first Easy Rollins mystery, Devil in a Blue Dress, was set in post-World War II Los Angeles. The just-published A Little Yellow Dog opens in mid-November 1963, and that ominous date gives the entire novel an anxious edge. The Easy we meet here is a more straight-laced citizen than the loose-hipped, streetwise operator Denzel Washington played in the movies. For the past 2 years, Easy has been caring for his 2 adopted children and working as head custodian at a junior high school. But one fateful morning, teacher Ida Bell Turner seduces him on top of her desk, and as he confesses, 2 years of up early and off to work dissolved like a sugar cube under the tap. Barely has the post-coital glow faded from Easy's face when Ida Bell and 2 other folks turn up dead. Fall guy Easy is left with Ida Bell's snarly yellow mutt and 3 pounds of smuggled heroin on his hands. The plot of A Little Yellow Dog is pretty streamlined as E.Z. Rollins' mysteries go and lacks the loving recreation of period music, social behavior, and slang that have informed the other novels. Still, Moseley rivets readers with the omnipresent threat that Easy's hard-won respectability could be torn away from him at any moment. Unthinkable things can and do happen in this novel. After all, it is set in November 1963. Like Easy, Virginia Chief Medical Examiner Kay Scarpetta has had to hang tough to command respect from the hard-boiled white guys who populate her world. Patricia Cornwell's morgue maven is a rarity in the ranks of women detectives. She's a high-level insider who, unlike, say, Kinsey Milhone, wields a lot of institutional power. That's part of the fun of reading this series, watching a no-nonsense woman use and sometimes abuse her authority just like one of the boys. In Cause of Death, the seventh Kay Scarpetta mystery, our heroine once again demonstrates that she's earned her clout. When the corpse of a scuba diver is discovered at Virginia's inactive naval shipyard, Kay insists on diving alone to view the crime scene. The icy Elizabeth River, however, is the color of old pennies, and in an eerie set piece, Scarpetta literally bumps into the dead man in the watery dark. Tautly plotted and disturbing to the spirit, Cause of Death topically features a rogue band of religious survivalists who want to hasten Judgment Day by blowing up a nuclear reactor. This is standout mystery reading, so hard to put down, your arms will tingle with intimations of rigor mortis. Susan Isaacs specializes not in suspense, but in surprise fiction, an updated Victorian form in which delicious revelations are planted like fudgesicles on every 10th page. Lily White, her latest novel, is a big, splashy, plot-driven book that deftly tells two tales. One focuses on criminal defense attorney Lily, a.k.a. Lee White's maneuverings to clear her gigolo client of murder charges. The second chronicles Lee's personal life, beginning with her Goodbye Columbus girlhood on Long Island. Isaacs creates a droll portrait of Lee's wasp wannabe parents, her father, the fur coat king, her mother, Sylvia, who looked like Lauren Bacall's twin sister who could not lay off the halva. But as it traces Lee's rivalry with her sister and her marriage to a Gatsby-type goy, the novel takes on darker shadings. By the end of Lily White, Isaacs has treated us not only to an entertaining legal drama, but to a chilling account of family scapegoating that reads like one of Freud's famous case studies turned into a miniseries. Reading this smart, sassy book on the beach will be the very picture of civilization and its contents.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Villard Books, publisher of Senator George McGovern's new book, Terry, My Daughter's Life and Death Struggle Against Alcoholism. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. And now it's my pleasure to present a concert and interview with one of today's finest interpreters of American popular song, Susanna McCorkle. Music critic Frances Davis called her the outstanding female jazz singer of her generation and praised her composer songbook series of recordings as the best since Ella Fitzgerald's. The first in that series, featuring Johnny Mercer songs, has just been reissued. And McCorkle's new CD is devoted to the songs of Cole Porter. She gives fresh interpretations to his familiar songs and rediscovers some wonderful obscure ones. Before our concert, let's hear something from the CD. Here's a delightful Cole Porter song you don't hear much. It's called Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Who has an itch to be filthy rich? Who gives a hoot for a lot of loot? Who longs to live a life of perfect ease and be swamped by necessary luxuries? Who wants to be a millionaire? I don't have flashy flunkies everywhere. I don't. Who wants the bother of a country estate? A country estate is something I'd hate. Who wants a fancy foreign car? I don't. Who wants to tire of caviar? I don't. Who wants a marble swimming pool too? I don't. I don't. 'Cause all I want is you. Who wants to be a millionaire? Who wants uranium to spare? Who wants to journey on a gigantic yacht? Do I want a yacht? Oh, how I do not. Who wants to wallow in champagne? Who wants a supersonic plane? Who wants a private landing field too? I don't, I don't. All I want is you.
Susanna McCorkle from her new Cole Porter CD, Easy to Love. Our concert with Susanna McCorkle was recorded in May at the annual public radio conference at a hotel in Washington, D.C. In the audience were program directors, station managers, and producers from around the country. But what never showed up was the grand piano we had ordered. It apparently got stuck in a traffic jam. So at the last minute, we wheeled in an old upright that had been in storage at the hotel. Accompanying Susanna McCorkle at this upright was Cliff Corman. Many of the songs in Susanna McCorkle's repertoire date back to the 20s and 30s, but she faces a dilemma. Some of the lovely melodies of the period have badly dated lyrics. Susanna, one of the things you really specialize in is finding songs from the past, wonderful songs. And when you're singing lyrics from the past, the values then are different than the values today. So do you find that a lot of songs are like too sexist to be sung when you go into the past?
I did find that. I got interested in this kind of music about 25 years ago in Europe. I am a baby boomer, so I listened only to Top 40 when I was in high school and college. Then in Europe, I discovered all these great old American movie musicals and jazz and American popular song. And when I decided to take the plunge and try to be a singer, I did notice there were a lot of songs about, you know, Beat Me Up Again, I Love It.
Yeah. And,
this was before Women's Lib, but it's still, I didn't really like it too much. So I thought, well, I'll just leave all those out. I won't say Beat Me Up Again, I Love It in songs. I'll find songs that say something else. So I consciously left them out. But then it, you know, the whole politically correct thing, it's really mushroomed. And there's an awful lot that has to be left out now.
Sing a few bars of a song that you couldn't possibly sing.
Well, I couldn't possibly do that, but I will sing a song. I actually do sing this. I did a medley of women's songs written by men over the years. And this one is from the 1920s, recorded by Annette Hanshaw.
Pies I'll be baking, and rugs I'll be shaking, and beds I'll be making for you. Cooking and spicing and spreading cake icing to make life enticing for you.
That's great.
See, people laugh now. 5 years ago, they booed. I consider this progress. It is, yeah.
Do you go through periods of purging your repertoire of certain songs and then thinking, but it's a lovely melody, I'm going to put it back in and just do it as a period piece?
I do that. I sang My Man at the Algonquin because it really is a beautiful song. I got some booze there.
That has the, you know, he beats me too line in it.
Yeah, he beats me too, what can I do? Yeah. But I did think, you know, when I sang that song, I left out the parts that were objectionable to me and to the audience for a while. And then I realized, you know, that is the song, and women do still allow themselves to be beaten today. And it was, so I just said, I'm going to be this woman and try to understand this point of view, that you love a man so much that you just won't leave him. And the most important thing in your life is not even this man, but having such a great and undying love. And it was very instructive to me. You know, I had a lot more understanding for those women. But it is hard. I mean, in L.A., right after the earthquake, I was playing there. I came out and did my usual opener. Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? You know, it's a minefield. It's out there these days. My real test is, could a man also sing this song?
She beats me, too.
Well, yeah. So, anything like that. You can say, I'm lonesome, I need you, I want to be in love. But you can't say, beat me up, I love it, or without a man, or without you, I'm nothing.
I want to talk with you a little about your life and how you started singing. It seems to me like when you were at the age that women are supposed to fall in love, and men are supposed to fall in love, and meet the person of their dreams and get married, what you fell in love with was song. You were just out of college, you were in Europe, and you just became infatuated with music.
Yes, I had tried to fall in love, but nobody would fall in love back with me. So I went to Europe, and I loved Europe and museums and art and, oh, Paris. And I also thought Europeans knew everything. And then I discovered Europeans loved American jazz of the 1930s and movie musicals. All the art cinemas played Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and Busby Berkeley constantly. And a lot of old movies like Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, I had never seen growing up because I wasn't European. You know, in college at Berkeley, it was not Europe. So, you know, not of any interest. And then a friend of mine played me a Billie Holiday record, and I could not believe my ears. I had never heard her. I had only heard Broadway show tunes at home and top 40 music, Joan Baez and the Supremes and then acid rock, and kind of tuned out to music. And I heard Billie Holiday. I could not believe how real she sounded. That was the first thing. Her voice was kind of rough. She was not trying to sound pretty or cute or beckoning or be an actress. She just was, and so were the musicians, and it was like lightning striking. I couldn't believe how wonderful she was and the effect her records had on me.
Susanna, can you do one of the songs that you first heard Billie Holiday sing, one of the songs that inspired you to sing?
Oh, yeah. When I first heard her records in Paris, all I wanted to do was borrow the records and hear them all the time. I memorized them all. And when I first moved from Rome to London to sing, I was only doing Billie Holiday songs wearing 1930s clothes that I'd bought in Portobello Road. I mean, I was into this. And it was actually British jazz musicians who said, it's great to love Billie Holiday. It's amazing that you're a kid and you love her, but you owe it to American jazz, because you're American, not to recreate records, but to do something of your own. So stop singing all Billie Holiday songs for a while. Do others. So I did. I took that very seriously. And it's only in the recent, maybe the last 7 or 8 years that I've come back to those Billie Holiday songs feeling like myself. So it's really a thrill for me to sing them. And in a way, every song I sing is a tribute to Billie Holiday, but especially when I do these, I love it. This is one she recorded in the 1940s, which is about my favorite period for her records, I think. It's that old devil called love again. Gets behind me and keeps giving me a shove again, putting rain in my eyes, tears in my dreams, and rocks in my heart. It's that sly old son of a gun again. He keeps telling me that I'm the lucky one again. But I still have that rain, still have those tears, and those rocks in my heart. Supposing that I wouldn't play, didn't stay, ran away, that devil, what a potion he would brew.
He'd follow me around, build me up, tear me down, till I'd be so bewildered I wouldn't know what to do. Might as well give up the fight again. I know darn well he'll convince me that he's right again. When I hear that siren song, I just gotta tag along with that old devil.
We'll get back to our concert and interview with Susanna McCorkle and pianist Cliff Corman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our concert and interview with Susanna McCorkle, recorded in May at the annual Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Cliff Corman is at the piano. Susanna does a lot of songs from Broadway and movies, movie musicals, and you do a version of Guys and Dolls, in for which you found a lyric that I've never heard.
Dave Frischberg found it.
Oh.
Somebody who's been on your show and is a great friend of mine. I heard his recording in a tribute to Frank Lesser. I know you love Frank Lesser.
Oh,
so do I. And I said, Dave, that is a fantastic new lyric you wrote to that song, because he writes great, funny lyrics. And he said, I didn't write that. Frank Lesser wrote that. I was amazed. And I sang it in New York, and Susan Lesser, Frank Lesser's daughter, was there. She had never heard it. This was cut from the Broadway show, the very last chorus that I sing. Do it?
Oh, please.
When you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you see a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that would flatten the Taj Mahal, call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some doll. When you meet a Joe banking half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some doll. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, chances are that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum fal de rol, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12 to 7 that the guy's only doing it for some doll. And his cash has run short, you can bet that he's saving it for some doll. When he's all dressed up with his tails gleaming white, who the hell do you think he's tickling pink on Saturday night? When a lazy slob
gets a good honest job, and he smells of Vitalis and Barbasol. Call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some doll. On the other hand, when you meet a dame taking pounds off her frame, you can't bet she's reducing it for some guy. When you see a doll with her diamond in hock, chances are that that rock is going to restock some gentleman jock. When you see a mouse hurry out of her house, and she runs 20 blocks for cigars and rice, call it dumb, call it clever, oh, but you can give odds forever that the doll's only doing it for some guy, some guy, some guy. The doll's only doing it for some guy.
We'll get back to our concert and interview with Susanna McCorkle and pianist Cliff Corman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our concert and interview with Susanna McCorkle, recorded in May at the annual public radio conference in Washington, D.C. Cliff Corman is the pianist.
Now, something you should know about Susanna McCorkle, she's not only a great singer, but she's a writer. She's in the, I think, 1975 O. Henry Award collection of short stories. She's written articles that have been published about Bessie Smith and Ethel Waters, and she translates lyrics from the Portuguese into English, as we're about to hear. How did you start doing this? Translating
well, with along with Top 40 Music, I heard The Girl from Ipanema, Stan Getz, Astrud Gilberto, and João Gilberto in the 60s, and I especially loved João Gilberto and the sound of Brazilian Portuguese. So in Europe, I listened to more of that, and I started singing along, and I even studied Portuguese a little so that I knew what I was singing. And then when I moved to London and the jazz musicians there said, don't just do Billie Holiday songs, I thought, well, okay, then maybe I'll sing some bossa novas in Portuguese and English. So I did that, and people really liked them. Of course, people just love those songs anyway. And then when I moved back to the United States after 10 years in Europe, I started singing more, and Portuguese I knew, the more I realized that during the bossa nova craze, a lot of those lyrics had been translated for top 40, Tin Pan Alley mm-hmm. tastes. It's a very deep and beautiful poetry, and there's a kind of sweet melancholy about it that's really wonderful that it was felt would not translate to an American audience, and they were right. You know, we don't talk about death, killing ourselves, and things like that in a pop song, but they do. So,
well, I'd like you to do a song that you call The Waters of March. That's a Jobim song.
Well, he called it that.
He calls it, okay.
I also call it that.
What I love about this translation, what I love about this translation is that, I mean, I don't know the Portuguese, and I don't know what, you'll tell us what the song says in Portuguese. I guess it's what you've said it says in the translation. But I just feel like Susanna has chosen words that not only have an interesting meaning, but they have the right sound. All the words seem to sonically work just right
in your translation?
Well, this actually, by this time, Jobim was translating his own songs. My theory is that he got really fed up with paying 50% royalties to people who didn't convey the meaning of the songs. I don't know that because I was too shy ever to meet him. But he did a very literal translation of this song with some things that just don't make sense. For example, the stump of a tree, he would say the rest of a tree, because it's resto de toco in Portuguese. And he would say the riverbanks talk of the waters of March, which is falando, talking. But it's not talk. It's kind of hard in English, so I said sing. You know, I just changed a few things, and I kept tinkering and tinkering with it, and wanted to get in his fun with language and the sounds of words, as you said, and also to make some things rhyme, because that's a convention we have, that things should rhyme. And also, still, to convey his meaning, it's kind of stream of consciousness about all the objects in the world, the big things, the little things, the abstract things, the beautiful things, the scary things, the boring things. And it's the Waters of March is about the emergence of the earth from into spring, but also the way the creeks melt and start flowing down the mountainside. He lived in New York 6 months a year, so this was, people have said, well, in Brazil, the seasons are reversed, ha! You know, but he wrote this and knowing that half the year he spent in America, in the United States of America. And it's, to me, it's also about the rebirth of the human spirit. I was coming through a very dark time at that time, and I said, this is the song. The song is saying not just that spring comes to the earth, but spring comes back to the human heart. And that's when you look around and you see all these things around you that you've taken for granted or been bored by or hated. And they're all beautiful, wonderful, miraculous. And you see how the tiny pieces of life fit together and make sense. Finally, they really do. And your heart just springs to life again. And it's an amazing moment. That's what the song is to me.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. É pão, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É resto de toco, pouco sozinho. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. It's feeling alone, it's the weight of your load. It's a sliver of glass, it's life, it's the sun. It's night, it's death, it's a knife, it's a gun. A flower in bloom, a fox in the brush, a knot in the wood, the song of a thrush. A mystery of life, the steps in the hall, the sound of the wind and the waterfall. It's the moon floating free, it's the curve of the slope. It's an ant, it's a bee, it's a reason for hope. And the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of spring, it's the joy in your heart. Estradeira, passarinho na mão, pedra de atiradeira, e uma ave no céu, uma ave no chão, um recato, uma fonte, pedaço de pão, e no fundo do poço, o fim do caminho, no rosto descosto, pouco sozinho, a spear, a spike, a stake, a nail, it's a drip, it's a drop, it's the end of the trail. The dew on the leaf in the morning light, the shot of a gun in the dead of the night, a mile, a must, a thrust, a bump, it's the will to survive, it's a jolt, it's a jump, blueprint of a house, a body in bed, a car stuck in the mud, it's the mud, it's the mud, a fish, a flash, a wish, a wing, it's a hawk, it's a dove, it's the promise of spring, and the riverbank sings of the waters of March, it's the end of despair, it's the joy in your heart. Sozinho, eu acobrei pão em João e José, um espinho na mão e um corte no pé. São as águas de março fechando o verão. É promessa de vida no teu coração. A stick, a stone, it's the end of the road. The stump of a tree, it's a frog, it's a toad. A sigh, a breath, a walk, a run, a life, a death. The rain, the sun, and the riverbank sings of the waters of March. It's the promise of life, it's the joy in your heart. São as águas de março fechando o verão. É promessa de vida no teu coração. É pão, é pedra, é o fim do caminho. É um resto de toco, um pouco sozinho. Pão, pedra, caminho, toco. Sozinho, pão, pedra, pão, pedra, pão, pedra, pão, pedra, pão, pedra, pão, pedra, pão.
Susanna McCorkle with pianist Cliff Corman, recorded last May at the annual Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Our concert was produced by Art Ellis and edited by Kathy Wolf. Our post-production engineer was Joyce Lieberman, who recorded the concert with Richard Parker. Special thanks to Laura Tyson and the Roland Corporation. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross. Here's more from Susanna McCorkle's new CD, Easy to Love, The Songs of Cole Porter, on Concord Records. Have a great holiday weekend.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice by the fire, while the breeze on high sang a lullaby. You'd be all that I could desire. Under stars chilled by the winter, under an August moon burning above, you'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to and love.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.